Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
See.
Watch.
Yes. Watch. See? The little green light. When I look at that, I always feel sleepy. Makes me want to sleep. Sleep. I am your superior. Here are my instructions. Listen carefully. Here is what I want you to do. I am going to count from four down to one, and then you are going to make a full report on the social conversion of number six. Four. Three. Two. One.
Everything went as planned, sir. We created the illusion of a full ultrasonic dislocation of the frontal lobes of the brain.
How was this done?
By using just sound. No ray, no focal point.
The patient lost consciousness?
The result of an intradermal injection of mitol I gave him.
I see. How was the illusion maintained?
The patient is being kept heavily tranquilized.
Well done, 86.
Thank you, sir. Was there anything further?
Yes. Here are your final instructions. Listen carefully. This is what I want you to do. When the village clock strikes four.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Libya is in flames, and despite no resolution at the United Nations, Syria gets a personal ultimatum from the Secretary-General, Ban Ki-moon. And with more ultimata flying around, it's time for one of our occasional situation reports on the Middle East. Like Libya's Colonel Gaddafi, Syria is reported to be ripe for regime change and President Assad has to go. But as we'll hear, NATO and their allies may be at work inside Syria arming protest groups. Starting with Libya and Syria, we take a tour around the region to see the lie of the land and cross no man's land to hear what the Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad makes of it all. Plus, the estranged wife of US Marine Corps Colonel George Griggs spills the beans about cults and psychological warfare against US citizens by the US military. Is the triumph of evil inevitable, since the most ruthless and greedy will stop at nothing to seize power? But first, as Martin Summers is always reminding us, war and financial disaster historically go together. So what do you make of Newsnight economics editor Paul Mason blowing away the political myth there are no more bullets in the clip, as he did last night? Greece, he says, the front risk of contagion. It's the first risk of contagion, with Spain, Italy, Ireland and Portugal also could maybe get contaminated from Greece and other places. Well, first of all, Martin, can you just explain what Paul Mason meant last night when he said that actually there are bullets in the clip, but there's not the political will to use them to sort the economy out?
Well, what he's talking about is the European Central Bank could buy, create euro bonds. This is what they've been talking about. In other words, basically that they would underwrite the situation in the southern European periphery. There's resistance to that in Germany. The French are less resistant. But, of course, all of this is essentially, what's the word? It's not going to solve the fundamental problems. It's just a way of trying to manage the crisis. There are potential for other things to be done to manage the crisis, but the solutions are still elusive. I mean, that is not going to solve the crisis fundamentally. I mean, the fundamental problem is that the banks are bust, and all of these, we're running around the houses trying to not to face up to the reality.
So the answer is what? Nationalisation?
We've nationalised the banks, but we haven't asserted control over them.
Well, we haven't nationalised all of them, have we? With Barclays, for example.
No, but Barclays, I mean, Barclays, if we do have a banking crash, Barclays will go down as well. The fact that, I mean, they are all claiming to make profits on the basis of misaccounting, essentially. They're all carrying lots and lots of junk bonds on there and another junk on their books, which they're being allowed to count as if it was full price. It isn't full price. Basically, the banks went bust in 2008, and the whole of the political class has committed itself to trying to make the private banks profitable again, but that actually is the wrong thing to do. Now, they should have asserted control over them, but there was no will to do that.
Paul Mason last night was named four different solutions that he would see, a fairly obvious possible solutions, but none of which the politicians are actually going to actually do, because there isn't the political will to do it for some reason. One was breaking up the euro, the other one nationalisation, they talked about protectionism, and also a possible abolishing of the minimum wage. So if any of those, why is it that none of those things, not that any of them are particularly one better than the other, but why is it?
The nationalisation option is better than the other three, but it needs to be actually carried through. What we've done is we've chucked loads of money at the banks, but we've not actually asked anything in return from them. The idea being that the government's such a bad organisation that the banks should be bailed out by the government, but then they should be left alone to try and make profits without the government's interference. This is just capitalist ideology. Once you've bailed them out, you're in charge of them, you should take them over and have done with it.
So you're saying that until there actually is a really serious political crisis as well as the financial crisis, nothing's going to be done? This is
as has been pointed out by Professor Michal Chosudovsky on his website globalresearch.ca. I recommend it to our listeners. What's happened is not the nationalisation of the banks, it's the privatisation of the state. So now the state, whether it's elected or democratic or semi-democratic or not democratic at all, basically has to do what the banks want. So by bailing the banks out, instead of getting control over the banks have got control over the state. Now that is not an economic problem, that's a political problem. We've got all the goodwill, they've got all the artillery. And we need to basically assert control over the financial services sector. We're not doing it.
I didn't see in the news anywhere that the government had been privatised, Martin.
I'm afraid they have, because the banks are now dictating what will happen on the back of the fact that we've bailed them out. It's like, you know, it's like...
Surely we're in the driving seat, aren't we? If we've bailed them out...
No, what's happened is the politicians have bailed the banks out. The banks are now dictating what will happen, and the politicians are caving, because there isn't a mass movement against the banks. The people have basically been bamboozled by the politicians into believing that somehow things will be all right if we just leave them alone.
You don't need a mass movement. You need one or two people in the Treasury to tell the banks what to do.
No, you need the President of the United States to kick some whatever you want to call it. But I mean, Obama basically came to power funded by Goldman Sachs and other top Wall Street firms.
But Obama doesn't control the pound; he controls the dollar. Sure.
No, well, also, but also, of course, no political force in Britain is saying that the banks have to be brought to heel. Everybody's terrified of saying such a thing, because of course once you start saying that, then the banks definitely will collapse, and then the government will be left holding the baby.
What do you mean they will do it? They will actually voluntarily collapse, or what?
If one of the things, if the government starts to assert itself, is that the banks will then say, oh well, we're going to go into liquidation then, as a way of avoiding you telling us what to do. But they are going to go into liquidation one way or the other anyway, and what we really need to have done is wound up the banks in an orderly fashion. It's what Webster Tarpley calls the zombie banks, with the kited derivatives. You should just, once you've bailed the banks out, which was probably inevitable, if you let them crash at that stage, you have chaos. Having bailed the banks out, you then wind them up. You sack all the existing managers, you change completely their rules of operation. Basically, you nationalise the private sector of financial system, and therefore there will be no private banks in the future.
But as you've said...
But of course, nobody's accepting that the private banking era is over. We're all trying to get the private banks back into good health. There's no point. We need to just get rid of the private banking system.
As you've said, the opposite's taken place. The banks have actually privatised the government. The opposite.
Yes, in other words, they're getting taxes now to pay off the bad debts that they ran up. Now, that is just a rubbish deal for the rest of the society. And eventually, when the banks collapse, as they will, the society will wake up that they've been had. It's like the sting. We've been giving the money to the banks, and then suddenly we're going to realise that they've left the back of the shop with all that money, and that's our money. And when we say, where's the money going to come from to solve the problems of the society, to create new hospitals, schools and nursery schools, for example, where are we going to get the money from? Well, that money is the money that's being paid out as bonuses and share options now. That's the money which we need to get back. And that will have to be done through redistribution and probably nationalisation without compensation.
Well, this kind of ultimatum you're talking about, that the banks have kind of holding a gun to the government, almost sounds like mafia tactics.
It is. A lot of what the banks have been doing is actually illegal under existing law, but they don't want to prosecute. Like Goldman Sachs, for example, was selling derivatives out of the front of the shop, which were deliberately designed to fail, and then their top managers were betting on the failure of those derivatives. That is fraud. But the reason they won't prosecute anybody for fraud, because if they prosecute just some people for fraud, they'd have to prosecute them all. I say prosecute them all, because that saves the problem of, if we raise taxes on the wealthy, then they'll all go off to Bermuda. No, they won't, because they're all going to be in prison and all of their assets are going to be confiscated.
Well, it's going to be a little
and
bit...
nobody's going to be prepared to follow that line until they realise that the system is finally broke. And when it's finally broke, people are going to realise we're going to have to take the money off the people who've got it, and some of them are going to have to go to prison. They should be lucky that they're only going to prison. If this was communist China in 1949, they'd be put up against a wall. Now, that's how serious the situation is. It's them or us, and it's got to be them.
Well, Freeview Channel, Russia Today's economics pundit, describes the bankers as financial terrorists. And according
to him, right.
And according to him, the dollar and other currencies may be going to crash to zero within the next few months, and possibly sooner than that.
Hi, I'm Max Kaiser. This is the Kaiser Report. Wait a minute. Before we get started, I'm going to make a prediction based on this debt ceiling debacle and the suggestion that the Pentagon would have to get some cuts. Per today's Financial Times, I'm predicting false flag terror attack in the next 90 days. Because remember, you can't cut the military budget in America. Because what's America without a military budget that exceeds all other military budgets of every country around the world?
That's Max Kaiser's report from last week, end of last week, Martin. He's saying a false flag terror attack. Well, what is that? And secondly, why is he saying that that's going to happen?
Well, I don't know why he's saying it's going to happen. He may have some inside knowledge, either from the United States or from the Russian military, who he talks to all
saying,
the time.
He's saying that the Pentagon will simply not accept budget cuts from the American government.
No, they won't. I mean, that this super Congress, unless it can agree, 50% of the cuts have to come from the military budget if they can't agree. So the prospect of some cuts in US military spending are on the horizon. In actual fact, if you cut US military spending, most of the deficit would disappear. If we had the same tax system in Britain and the US that we had in the 1950s or even the 1960s, there would be no budget deficit. What we've got is the capture of the state by vested interests, that is to say, financial speculators and the military-industrial complex, and democracy is basically disappearing in front of our eyes as a result of that. But the answer to that is to enforce democratic control over the military-industrial complex and the banks, isn't it?
And he's also saying that he thinks that currencies could soon crash to zero. If he's looking at what everyone's doing, apparently, is taking their investments out of currencies like the dollar and putting them into gold.
Well, that's right, because the quantitative easing basically means that you're printing money, and eventually investors will get panicked out of fiat currencies and go to things like gold and oil. That's what they're doing.
Is that possible, that the dollar could go
yes,
down to virtually
absolutely,
a zero
absolutely,
value?
Absolutely, because once you get a crash, it doesn't just go down to what's a rational price for the dollar or a rational price for the euro. When you have a panic, everybody wants to sell. And that's one of the things that markets do. They overshoot. They don't just drive the dollar down to some rational level. They drive it down below that level. And then you get all sorts of chaos. And I'm afraid that's where we're going. And the mainstream political class, including Kerry, a member of my party, the mainstream political class don't actually want to contemplate what is going to happen. We are going to have a crash far worse than 1929. And the consequences are going to be far more drastic. And then, and only then, will people start to wake up and realise what's at stake here.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Now, we're joined by local peace campaigner Joanne Baker. Hi, Jo, and welcome to Drive Time.
Oh, hi there.
Now, you've come in to talk about Libya, I believe, today. Now, can you just tell us what's been going on over there?
Yeah, it's very interesting, really, because I think what's the most frightening thing about this particular war is the complete media blackout we're seeing, not only from the BBC, but The Independent, The Guardian. Al Jazeera is blacking out. It's very, very difficult to get information about what's going on. And when you do start looking at what is really, really happening there, you find it's a bit like Alice in Wonderland, that everything is the opposite of what it appears.
Okay, so yes. In what way is what we're being told by the mainstream press, the BBC and people like that, what way do you think that that's, you know, something wrong with that? How do you disagree?
Well, the whole point of Europe and NATO, you know, being involved in the first place was some rather extraordinary allegations that Gaddafi was hurting his own people. So we had to rush in as great knights in shining armour and try and do something about it. But what's happening now is that the stories we heard at the beginning have not been corroborated in fact. And the people are suffering extraordinarily at the moment, but not from Gaddafi, in fact from NATO. And it's very similar, I'm finding it's very, very similar to Iraq in 1991, where they put on the sanctions, the embargo, they froze all the assets, and then they started to bomb. And we're told they're bombing military targets. Well, they may be, but they're also bombing out the civilian infrastructure, including the water pipeline, the factory that makes the pipes for the great man-made river. They've bombed food stores, they've bombed hospitals, they've bombed ambulances, and the people in Libya are really beginning to suffer. And I think particularly from shortages of fuel, electricity, medicines, it's really beginning to hurt them now.
Now, the Russian President Vladimir Putin recently explained to a Scandinavian audience the ease by which, as Joe was just talking about, civilians can be killed by the military nowadays.
It's well known that I used to serve in the KGB. At the time, the Soviet Union was waging a war in Afghanistan. Many of my friends served in Afghanistan. One of them was the head of the advisors group on the security bodies in Herat. One day, he went on leave, and I asked him, "Listen, Sasha, how's the situation down there?" And at that time, our country had a very patriotic spirit. We believed that we were doing a very good thing, having this war in Afghanistan. His reply came back unexpectedly. "You know, without my signature, not a single missile or bomb can be fired." "So what?" I asked. "I assess my success and my achievements by the number of orders that I don't sign." For me, this sounded shocking. Can you imagine hearing that from a KGB officer at the time? I asked him why. He said, "Do you know how many peaceful civilians perish because of these missile attacks, no matter what reasons are behind them?" Sometimes I contemplate how easily decisions on using force are made today in international affairs, and it leaves me gobsmacked. And that happens against the background of all the fuss around the human rights and humanism, which the modern civilized world seemingly practices. Don't you see a significant contradiction here between theory, the words and deeds, and the practice of international affairs? And we should do our utmost to eliminate this imbalance.
That was the Russian President Vladimir Putin, well, not actually him, someone translating him, speaking in Scandinavia a couple of months ago. Martin, what about this concept that has been talked about there, is that the success is the number of weapons not used? This sounds a little bit strange.
Well, not really. I mean, if you're fighting a war, modern 21st century warfare is about perceptions, about hearts and minds. So every time you drop a bomb that kills somebody that you didn't mean to kill, then their family have been turned against you. And I think in actual fact, the stuff I've been reading suggests that Gaddafi's support inside Libya has strengthened as a result of the NATO bombing campaign. For example, there are power cuts now in Tripoli, and people aren't blaming Gaddafi, they're blaming the NATO warplanes which bomb the electricity substation. stations. And, you know, they're going to find it very difficult to storm Tripoli. I think that they started this war in advance. People look up Operation Southern Mistral 2011, they'll find it on the internet. It's been up on the French Air Force website since November last year, which was a war game, basically, of attacking Libya in exactly the way that it's been attacked. These rebels were armed from the very beginning, were actually put up to their armed insurrection by NATO, but they haven't got the popular support to carry it through. And I'm afraid that the people in Libya are suffering very much unnecessarily as a result of all of this. Reforms can come about through peaceful change, but civil war is chaos, and that's what we've got in Libya now, which is the Iraqization, as Joe was pointing out. Let's say we won the war in Libya and captured Tripoli, well, then would begin the guerrilla phase, the insurgency phase. Basically, Libya is looking at a future of continued violence unless there is a political solution, which is what the Libyan government, with their allies, the Russians, have been saying all along. Why don't we sit down and talk about it and then come to some kind of agreement? But the West isn't interested. They want double or quits.
Now, Joe, that you comparing the situation, as Martin was as well, there with Iraq. But, I mean, at the beginning of the Iraq war, there wasn't a big insurgency against Saddam Hussein, was there, back in 2003?
Yeah.
But there was in Libya.
Well, I was really talking about Iraq in 1991, actually, because that was the point that the embargo was first put on, and when they really did target electricity and the water generation. And we saw in those years of sanctions, we saw thousands of children die from waterborne diseases. And this is exactly what the International Red Cross is saying now in Libya. It's saying there must be ability to get medicines in, to get the fuel, to get them to the places they need around the country.
Seems a bit ironic, doesn't it, since NATO started this whole thing in order to protect civilians. But what about the uranium weapons? Is there actually any evidence now that NATO has been using these uranium weapons, which are particularly hideous as they leave for tens of thousands of years and future generations all sorts of birth defects?
Yeah, I think there's absolutely no doubt. And there's been a group of scientists in Libya who have been investigating this. They've been going to the bomb sites. They've been taking readings, taking samples, and there is most definitely radiation there. I think the big question is what kind of, if they're using uranium weapons, are we just going to find depleted uranium, which we sort of know about, or is it going to be like scientists are finding in Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon now, traces of this low enriched uranium and an undepleted uranium, which remains a great mystery.
Okay, and who are the rebels?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention this really because, as Martin was saying, you know, this wasn't a peaceful start to the revolution there. It was actually fully armed, and it seems there's a guy in America called Webster Tarpley, who's been doing quite a lot of research on this, and he's finding out that in that eastern part of Libya, there's a lot of Al-Qaeda which went into Iraq and are fighting now in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And in 2007, some Americans did a study called the Point West Study, which was kind of looking into this. And they have, you know, it was even in that study, it was hinted that these people could be used against Gaddafi in Libya. And it seems very much this is actually what's happening at the moment. So we get this extraordinary thing happening where NATO forces are really fighting the same people in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan as they are now funding in Libya. And as he has said, they've actually opened an office now in Washington for these same Al-Qaeda forces. So it does make the world seem a bit mad.
It doesn't surprise me. I mean, Al-Qaeda have been cooperating with Western agencies all along, and this probably the case in Pakistan as well. The Islamic fighting group in Libya has been a protege of the Western intelligence services for many years. They have an office in London, but they are the Al-Qaeda Libya.
Didn't they also fund MI6?
According to Annie Mashin and Dave Shaler, who were MI5 officers, MI6 gave them money to try and assassinate Gaddafi, which they failed to do, but they managed to kill some civilians. Basically, what most people don't realise is that the extreme Islamist forces of Al-Qaeda are heavily integrated into the Western intelligence structure. So what they do is they set these people off and then they chase after them. So, oh, look, we've got Al-Qaeda there, so we've got to intervene. Same in Somalia, for example. In Libya, the Russian military gave a press conference at the very beginning of the conflict saying there is no evidence whatsoever that the Libyans are using aircraft against civilian demonstrators. There just haven't been any aircraft flying over eastern Libya. And of course, why they wanted to spread the story that aircraft had been used is because they had a plan to put in a no-fly zone to back up their protégés, the Transitional National Council, who seem to be they're bumping each other off at the moment. Nobody's quite sure who they are. They don't represent anybody. Nobody's been elected, but nobody elected any of these people, and reports are coming out of Benghazi that they're carrying out all kinds of atrocities against those who don't agree with them. Basically, it's a civil war inside Libya. I wouldn't say sitting here that I know who's doing what, but I certainly don't believe the story I'm being told by Western governments about it. They've got a vested interest in trying to break the Gaddafi regime so that they can get better contracts for their oil companies and so forth, and that's what it's all about. And I think it's pretty immoral to start wars in other people's countries. I mean, basically, if the Libyans were doing that here, we'd be pretty annoyed.
I mean, this is another aspect to it all, isn't it? That some companies are making a tremendous amount of money. Every cruise missile that's fired... Well,
every bullet that's fired is a cash register going ding for somebody. And as I said earlier, it's the military-industrial complex and the financial services industry have become Frankenstein's monsters. And if we don't stop them, they're going to bring... You know, it's us all them. It's got to be them.
So, Joe, what can we do?
I think we just need to break the silence, and I think it's really important in Europe. I think actually in the States people are more aware of what's going on, that here there's been a deafening silence, not only through all the media, but Stop the War, for example.
Except us, of course.
Yes, of course. These great exceptions, of course. But people need to know. I've got a charity called Child Victims of War, and if you go on the website, which is http://childvictimsofwar.org.uk, all the information I'm getting, I'm putting up on the Facebook there and on a page about Libya. So if anybody wants to know any more about this, they can go and find out there.
You've been to Iraq many times, have you not?
I have indeed, yeah. Which is why I'm quite frightened at the moment, because I can see it going very fast down that route. And the people who will really suffer will be the most vulnerable, and they will be the children. According to the Red Crescent, by July the 5th, 141 children have been killed by NATO and 641 injured, and there's far more that's happened since then. And it's actually, Britain is very much involved in this. We bombed Zlitan last week and killed 85 civilians, and 33 of those were children and 32 women. So our government is very much involved. Our planes go from Marham in Norfolk, if anybody wants to sort of demonstrate around there. And I do think this issue needs to be raised with all our politicians.
Well, it does sound like illegal, doesn't it, really? Surely we shouldn't be... Let me finish, Martin. I know you're really gagging to jump in there, but we've got something called the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We've also got something called the UN Security Council. Now, the UN Security Council, which is the most powerful nations on Earth, plus a few others in the Security Council, all signed up to a no-fly zone. And this has gone way beyond a no-fly zone. We're killing civilians and also destroying infrastructure. What can be done? Is that international law? It doesn't seem is in any way valid anymore.
Well, I mean, the Russians and the Chinese and others, the South Africans, abstained on the vote on a no-fly zone. And, for example, Stop the War, I think the perception was that this was an extension of the Arab Spring, and that maybe there was some justification in the West position. But looking at the further research shows that the West were planning to attack Libya before any of this happened, so they definitely set the whole thing up. Operation Southern Mistral 2011, people can just look it up on their computers and they will see that it was all planned in advance. And the other thing is that they've way exceeded a mandate for a no-fly zone. There was a no-fly zone in Bosnia when I was there in the 90s, and that just meant that the Serbs could not use their aircraft. It didn't mean that the Western aircraft were involved in the fighting. In fact, they flew overhead and ignored the fighting. Now, this is what's going on here is an attempt at regime change, which the British and the Americans and the French specifically went to the Security Council saying, we're not interested in regime change, we're only interested in humanitarian intervention. Now, that's clearly wrong. And, of course, we're going to come to Syria in a minute, and the Chinese, the Russians and others are saying, well, we don't believe what you say. You said you were going to have a no-fly zone over Libya, but you're up for regime change. Now you want us to help you over Syria. Well, sorry, that's not the way it works. You lied to us last time. We don't believe a word you say, and we're not going to back you. You will not get UN backing for anything you want to do about Syria. And they won't.
Well, Russian President Vladimir Putin recently explained to the same Scandinavian audience the ease by... Oh, sorry, that was the previous one. That the NATO should not have a right to actually kill Gaddafi. So, really, what he's saying is that because the regime change took no part in the UN resolution, but actually what they're doing now, NATO, and the British contingents in NATO, of course, part of that, is breaking international law.
The coalition said destroying Gaddafi was not their goal. Then why bomb his palaces? Now some officials have claimed that eliminating him was in fact their goal. Who gave them that right? Did he have a fair trial? Returning to the no-fly zone, the bombings are destroying the country's entire infrastructure. When the so-called civilized world uses all its military power against a small country, destroying what's been created by generations, I don't know if that's good.
Now, it seems, Martin, that was the Russian President Vladimir Putin there, that the Russians are the only people who are actually speaking out on this, really.
Well, no, I think you'll find there are others. The South Africans have taken quite an active role because they see themselves as leaders of the African Union. The OAU, the Organisation of African Unity, have made it very, very clear that they're not happy with what's happened because Gaddafi and the Libyan regime have been very generous to people in Africa.
Well, they can fold their arms and they can say we're not happy, but they're not actually prepared to do
it. Well, at what stage are people prepared to go to war with the United States of America and Britain? That's a good question. The Chinese threatened to go to war with us over the so-called assassination of Osama bin Laden a few weeks ago. You wouldn't have heard that on Radio 4, but if you read the English language press in India or Pakistan, you would know that the Chinese government said if you go into Pakistan again without getting permission from the Pakistani government, you will be going to war with China. It's the most serious ultimatum issued to the Western power since 1945, but in Britain most people are unaware that the Chinese have threatened to go to war with us. Now, if we keep having random wars through being absent-minded in Libya and Syria and Afghanistan and Pakistan and Somalia and all the other places that we're happy about having wars, then eventually we're going to be in a war, and then there will be a big bomb in Britain perhaps and kill hundreds of people, and people say, how did that happen? And you say, because you have been going around the world killing lots of other people and you don't seem to understand what you're doing, and maybe the only way to make you understand is that you have to have some blood right in your face. And that what may, I mean, if I was the Libyan intelligence services now, I'd be saying, right, there's a number of things we need to do. We need to kill some RAF personnel in Britain, preferably soft targets, so that we don't take too many risks. And of course, if they're going to try and kill our head of state, we should try and kill their head of state and his children. So find out where Cameron's children go to school and bump a couple of them off. Now, that sounds extreme, but that is exactly the British position in relation to the Libyan government. Now, if the Libyan government is fighting with its back against the wall, what would you do? What would we do if the Germans had invaded Britain? Would we be worried about their looking after them? I don't think we would.
The other thing with Gaddafi and the Libyan regime, they do certainly have their backs up against the wall slowly but surely over the last few months. And there certainly isn't going to be any let-up until September, NATO have said. That Gaddafi may have a few tricks up his sleeve, may have some weapons of mass destruction.
I think what Gaddafi is going to do, he isn't going to do any of the silly things I've suggested, because he knows ultimately this is a war for British and Western public opinion. So if he was to do anything silly like that, he would lose that. But on the other hand, I put it to my British fellow citizens, at what point is your complacency going to be shocked? Because you can't just absent-mindedly carry on starting wars. Basically, what really annoys me about comfortable people in Britain who like wars in other people's countries, they want to start these wars and then they want to go home and have a nice cup of tea. Well, I'm afraid that's not the real world. I was an aid worker in Bosnia. Joe's been to Iraq many times. People need to be reminded that it is not a game. And if you're going to start having wars, then wars are what you're going to have. And it's not a game at all.
Now, we'll move on now to talk about Syria. With regard to that, former Pentagon officer Michael Maloof believes there may have been a secret program to supply Syrian dissidents with weapons from outside. Again, that would break international law if it's true. And we've heard, of course, this week, an ultimatum, a phone call from Ban Ki-moon, Secretary General of the United Nations, directly to President Assad of Syria, demanding that he stop killing civilians and take the army out of his cities. So let's have a listen now to this former Pentagon officer, Michael Maloof.
This opposition seems to be more cultivated from outside, and I think that that is one of the problems that Assad is facing. It's not just internal unrest, although he's promised reforms, but you have a concerted effort by forces outside of Syria to topple that regime. I think it's a combination of the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. They see in Assad, ultimately, his alliance with Iran. Iran, to them, is the big problem. They see the spread of Iran in traditionally the Arab world. And Iran has scored heavily, not only in Iraq, but also in Lebanon. And Iran has made it very clear that it's going to support Assad. There's a lot more at stake with Syria. Given Iran's relationship, we've looked upon Bahrain, for example, as basically a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And I think you might say the same thing is actually occurring right now in Syria. But no one's going to say that openly.
Well, he's certainly saying it openly, and Martin, I understand there are others that are saying that they do believe that NATO and Israel and other allies may have troops in there, agents in there, actually giving arms to Syrian people in order to sort of foment unrest.
That's right, and one person who's certainly saying this is Roger Crook, which is spelt C-R-O-O-K-E. He's an MI6 officer, former MI6 officer based in Lebanon, who was actually involved with negotiations by the British government with Hamas and with other organisations in the Middle East. A senior ex-intelligence officer saying, well, that's exactly what's going on. Armed groups inside Syria are being encouraged to rebel by Western powers and by the Israelis. You can understand why Assad is saying, well, demonstrations are one thing, but if you're going to start shooting police officers, burning down police stations and so on, then there's going to be a civil war. And that's what civil war is being fomented in both Libya and in Syria by the Western powers. And that's what's going on. And I'm not saying I'm taking sides in this. I can understand why people might want to rebel against their governments. But for outside forces to encourage that kind of rebellion, like we're talking about 91 in Iraq, George Bush encouraged the Shia to rise up in the south of the country and then stood back while Saddam's forces repressed all of those people. And basically, I don't think it's moral to start civil wars in other people's countries. It's actually deeply immoral, and we shouldn't be doing it.
And it's against, it must be against international law.
It is against international law, of course it is. And of course, ultimately, if it's against international law, these people could and should be prosecuted. Never mind sending Gaddafi to the International Criminal Court. What about sending some of our people to it?
Well, yet again, I'm going to impress on you. International law doesn't really seem to mean anything anymore. It's just about what you can get away with.
Well, the International Criminal Court putting in a thing about Gaddafi and saying that Gaddafi got to be put on trial. The International Criminal Court is bringing itself into disrepute by doing that, because what it is doing is it's basically becoming a Western victor's justice business, and if that's what it becomes, then lots of people in the rest of the world will not take it seriously, and loads of people in Africa don't take it seriously already because of that very fact.
So how do you see things going, Martin, in Syria? Because there really has been an ultimatum this week to the president, sanctions kicking in, I wonder if there are any particular events in Syria's recent history that you'd like to point out as quite significant in the run-up to what's happening now.
Well, I mean, the fighting is clearly going to continue in both countries, sadly, although, you know, negotiations could be... I mean, what I would be doing if I was the Western powers, I'd be saying, look, goodness me, let's negotiate. Let's get everybody around a table and discuss some kind of solution for this. Basically, the regime in Syria has got its back against the wall, and they will fight to the end because they've got no other options. Assad does have popular support inside Syria, just as Gaddafi has popular support inside Libya. I wouldn't like to guess how much, but you've got to remember that these are very fractured societies with lots of different ethnic minorities. Assad is from the Alawite minority that have run the Syria for many years. There's a Sunni majority in Syria who might not be happy with him. In Libya, Gaddafi has something between 70%, 50% support. Nobody's sure, but there's certainly the case that both regimes have enough support to hang on, which basically means there's going to be a bloodbath in both countries. I hope the people in the West who set all this off are happy with themselves.
Yeah, I'd just like to add there that Iraq, Syria and Libya are all secular countries in the region, and if you see what's happening in Iraq, it's very bad news for women. Women are suffering like they have never suffered before, and I really fear that if Syria and Libya go, it won't be greater democracy, it'll be much greater religious fundamentalism. And when you're also with the Christians in the region, because there are many, many, many Christians inside Syria who've been there for thousands of years, and those from Iraq left to go there, so I think it would be very, very bad news for them.
Okay, Martin, also on this whole business with Syria, I wonder, is it Rafik Hariri who was killed? He was a Syrian.
No, he wasn't Syrian. He was a president of Lebanon.
He was a Lebanese guy, yeah. Was he? Okay, so because there is a border between the two. What seems to be happening,
just to summarise, is that there is an axis developing between the West, Saudi Arabia and Israel. And what we're really talking about is Western domination of the region. So Saudi Arabia, where they have no elections whatsoever, where the secret police have complete power over the population, where they are actually carrying out bombing raids into Yemen to support the West's protégés. The Saudis and the Israelis have got together with NATO to destabilise their enemies in Syria and in Libya. So what we're actually looking at is a Middle East war between an Iranian, Syrian, Libyan, Palestinian axis and an Israeli, Saudi, Western axis.
But if you're looking at the map, as I've got a map here in front of me, it's like the Saudi Arabia and Israel in the middle are sort of pushing outwards. We've got also, of course, they have control of Iraq now. They're pushing outwards to the east towards Iran and towards the west, towards Libya and Algeria.
Ultimately, a war against Syria would lead to a war with Iran, which the neocons in the US and the Israelis have been banging the drum for the last 5 years.
But there's
years.
No secret. There's no border between Syria and Iran. Iraq is sandwiched between the two.
Well, yes, and therefore Iraq becomes a battlefield, does it not? And it is a battlefield. We had massive bomb attacks in Iraq this week.
Yes, 60 died in simultaneous bomb attacks.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And of course, in actual fact, the politics of Iraq are being directed from outside, by outside forces, whether American or Iranian or whoever. I mean, basically, the policy the West has pursued towards the Middle East has been deeply immoral for many, many years. They've supported Israeli aggression, they've supported dictatorships, they're basically only interested in the oil, and the whole Arab Spring has turned into a summer of war. And the autumn is going to be the war. And it won't be any fun at all. As the banking system collapses, we're going to have a Middle East war, which could turn to a world war. Happy Christmas, everybody. Isn't it marvellous?
Well, Freeview Channel Russia Today this week interviewed the Iranian President Ahmadinejad about his thoughts on NATO and the Arab Spring so far. And this is what he had to say.
It's important to take note on the interference of NATO in the region. NATO has interfered in the affairs of Libya. The Security Council has made a mistake. Instead of sending bombs and planes to Libya, they should have sent mediation groups in order to prepare for free elections under the auspices of the UN, and whoever won the elections would be acceptable for the people. But the Security Council hastily issued a resolution, and it has complicated the situation that has led to the killings and the massacre of people and destruction of infrastructure in the country. Who is using military force in Bahrain? Are we doing that? Who is interfering in the internal affairs of the region? Show me one place or one location in the world where Iranian military forces are present. There is no such place. The British forces, American forces, NATO forces, they're around us everywhere. They're surrounding Iran. And those same forces say Iran is interfering in the internal affairs of the region. What could we say to that?
That was the Iranian President Ahmadinejad speaking earlier this week. Now, Martin, one of the things he says there is that the United Nations made a mistake when they went in to Libya. But surely it's really part of a wider war. Maybe he's being a little bit sort of polite by saying that.
Well, I mean, he's trying to get opinion in the United Nations to his side of way of looking at it. It was only the UN Security Council, don't forget, the UN General Assembly was not consulted, and the Security Council were basically bamboozled by the humanitarian argument.
So what
is clearly the humanitarian argument was a specious argument. The West wasn't interested in humanitarian intervention. It's actually a strategy to, basically, it's an imperialist strategy to dominate the region and dominate its resources. That's what's become clear.
So what's the difference between the Security Council and the General Assembly? I know the General Assembly includes every single
country. General Assembly includes all recognised countries, including, hopefully, Palestine come September, because they are pushing to be recognised by the UN General Assembly, and the Israelis are making a lot of fuss about that, and the West is making a lot of fuss about that not being allowed to take place. So we're looking at a general Middle East war being pushed by Western commercial interests and Zionist political interests, and it's pretty evil. It shouldn't be happening. It should be stopped.
What commercial interests over here?
Well, we're talking about the oil companies who are all flying around trying to, you know, the reason they didn't like Libya was because the Libyans drove a hard bargain with them, and they were driving a harder bargain with them to make sure that most of the profit from Libya's oil went to Libya's people. And when Gaddafi took over in Libya, the average person in Libya was extremely poor. Now they have universal healthcare, universal education. Anybody in Libya who reaches the standard can have free university education to any level, including going to foreign universities. That's not being provided in other parts of the world, in Egypt, for example, or in any of the other Western protege countries, where they basically do as they're told.
Well, the Libyans certainly used to score very, very high, didn't they, on the things like infant mortality was very low there. Well, they also had a very, very good literacy rate in Libya.
Well, exactly, and I think the idea that, I mean, that Gaddafi has been presented to us as this crazy man that we're supposed to hate. Inside Libya, he's now being regarded as a kind of Churchill figure, and I think that they're not going to win this war, but they can create an awful lot of mess before they lose.
Well, one of the countries right in the middle of this is Israel, and protests have been going on there too, but have got very little coverage in the Western mainstream press. Here's Laura Slear.
Tens of thousands on the streets of Israel, angry, fed up, and protesting for change. But is anyone listening?
When it comes to Israel, a lot of the foreign media want to see more of an action movie.
Well into week three, the largest demonstration in Israel in over a decade. Damir Mizrach isn't surprised by the worldwide lack of media interest. He's worked in the Israeli press for a decade, reporting for media both foreign and local.
There is a box that the international media has put Israel in, and that is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, also the Israeli-Lebanese and Syrian conflict. And anything that doesn't kind of fit into that is not the immediate type of news item, which is unfortunate.
That just makes Hannah Reyes and others angry. For 9 days, she's been camping here, furious that she can't make ends meet as a university student.
It makes me upset that when Egypt decided to stand up and say we've had enough, and when in Lebanon they decided to say we've had enough, the media was all over there. I haven't seen anyone from CNN or from Fox News or any other, you know, big news channel here, and it's really sad. We also deserve a chance to be heard out.
Well, blogger Danny Schechter says that the reality of life in Israel often goes unnoticed because the country only attracts coverage for its role in conflicts.
Many Americans think somehow the Israeli government is very popular. The leaders of Israel get a lot of attention in the American media. Israel is presented almost as a monolithic country when it's actually an extremely divided country. A massive protest of the kind we've seen in Israel about just the economic realities that people there are experiencing is something Americans have no understanding of, because there's no context and no reporting. Israel is only reported in the context of its its conflict with Iran or its conflict with Palestinians. The actual reality of life in Israel and what's happening to people there and how this right-wing government in Israel is handling the economy is something that we never really hear about. It's a very unstable situation. The economy there is very unstable as well. Well, you know, when you look at the Middle East, generally speaking, they talk only about the Arab countries. Only they have internal discord. You never hear about Israel's internal discord. And the fact that this uprising essentially is taking place in Israel, while at the same time there's one going on in Syria, there's one going on in Egypt, you know, shows that the same pressures are, you know, being experienced by Israeli people as well, which is inflation, economic pressure, food prices rising, all kinds of economic uncertainty.
So, Martin, why haven't we heard about this Israeli spring in our newspapers? This is something that was completely new to me.
Well, I mean, it has been reported, but, you know, as you know, a lot of serious things in the world are not reported in our newspapers. I mean, our riots, for example, in which a small number of people died, obviously dominated our news bulletins last week. So things going on in any foreign country get pushed aside when people start to get upset about their own personal circumstances in the country where they are.
So what's at the bottom of these big demonstrations, tens of thousands per
turning out? Well, to be honest, I think it's a rather positive development that Israelis are rebelling against their government because of its economic incompetence. And ultimately, of course, war is expensive. And having your country as an armed camp at constant loggerheads with your neighbours is an extremely expensive thing to do. And it doesn't actually do it doesn't butter any parsnips. I mean, the answer to a lot of these problems is to actually grasp the economic nature of them and resolve those economic imbalances and injustices. And of course the answer of powerful forces, military industrial complex in Israel, I mean, is very strong. I mean, some people say that Israel isn't a country with an army, it's an army with a country. And this is the problem in many parts of the world, is that the military and the financial people have basically dominated the agenda, and the ordinary folk are being pushed to the margin, and they're starting to rebel, and that's good. I mean, I think it's very positive that Israelis are finally waking up to the waste of money and the pointlessness of having a conflicts with all their neighbours.
But the worrying side to all this is, just as we're in this financial crisis, we're in the position where we're actually, you know, you would expect that most military spending would be reduced. I mean, the Cold War's finished. We don't really have an enemy anymore, apart from possibly Al-Qaeda. You would expect that all these military budgets would be reined back, and we'd be living in a much more peaceful world.
Well, that's precisely why we've had all these false flag terror attacks, which we were mentioning earlier and so on, including 9/11 and other similar events. The military-industrial complex doesn't want to go away. I mean, basically, a lot of people have made a very good living out of that military-industrial complex, and they will find wars to justify it. And unless we rein it in, we're going to lose control of the situation to people who are basically business fascists. And it's about time we recognise the seriousness of the situation and stood up for ourselves. And in Israel, some people are starting to do that. Good.
Now, we had a look at, you gave us some predictions for Syria. What do you think of the overall situation in the Middle East now and how it's going to pan out, particularly with reference to what seems to be at the centre of a lot of this, which is the conflict between Palestine and Israel?
Well, it's not looking good. The Palestinians are hoping to be recognised as an independent state, as a means of putting pressure on the Israelis, but the Israelis are creating more conflicts with other nations, including Syria, in order to kind of draw, you know, make sure that people don't have their attention drawn to the fundamental injustice that's been done to the Palestinians.
But what's going to happen if countries like Libya and Syria slowly, like dominoes, they fall down one by one, and then eventually, potentially, the Iranian regime crumbles, or we have regime change in Iran?
That is the wet dream of the planners in NATO and Tel Aviv. But in actual fact, like most wars, it's turning into a bit of a bloodbath. Everybody thought the World War I would be over by Christmas. We were promised that the Libyan business would be over in a week and a half, and there would be no need to carry on. I mean, I'll bet you we're going to be fighting in Libya and Syria into the new year, and probably fighting elsewhere as well. So I would say to people, before you set off on a war, think about the consequences, because wars can be lost as well as won. And in actual fact, NATO hasn't won a single war yet. Not one. Not really.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Now, to what extent is the Western military being used against its own people? That's us. Way back in 1997, the estranged wife of US Marine Corps Colonel George Griggs spilled the beans on film about cults and psychological warfare against US citizens by her husband and others in the US military. So we ask, after this has this improved since this interview was recorded over 10 years ago? Now let's have a listen now to Kay Griggs, the wife of US Marine Corps Colonel George Griggs.
There to have something on Bill. That's my own feeling. Mm-hmm. Sarah McLendon feels the same way.
Uh-huh.
Because...
And Linda Tripp was there to guide the situation.
Absolutely. Of course. Linda Tripp was Delta Force. Linda Tripp was trained by Carl Steiner, who's in the diary with my husband. Carl Steiner is called a snake.
And she begins by talking there about the whole Monica Lewinsky sex incident with Bill Clinton as a psychological operation by a part of the U.S. military called Delta Force.
And he tried to trip up Schwarzkopf. I mean, he was trying to take the whole Iraqi thing over because they had been baiting using the Israeli rogues in Turkey. They were having little zigzag wars. It's all to sell weapons. It's all about weapon sales. It's all about drugs. It's all about funny money. The head, Krulak, who is the commandant of the Marine Corps, his father, Victor Krulak, worked with this Czechoslovakian double agent who was worked with Al Gray, who was enlisted at that time, rose right up to the top because they were involved with Bucher and this whole crowd that was trying to pick fights. They were Army and Navy together, joint. George calls them the members of the firm. He calls them the members of the firm. I've heard the Brotherhood. They're very close. It's a small group, and it's very hierarchical. I had Caspar Weinberger's bodyguard farm me when I was at Sarah McLendon's. They're doing profiling on me. Women are hard to profile because we're very easy if you understand women. And I think they need more women in human intelligence because we solve a lot of these problems very quickly. Because we're the ones who teach the men how to talk, how to communicate. We think on 20 levels at once. You know, we're very spiritual. We're very practical all at the same time. And they make mistakes by pegging women as crazy when really they're very anxious to solve problems. They're just very frustrated to see a lot of wacko things going on that don't need to be going on, but the guys don't see it. So I call General Joy and I say, General Joy, this is Kay Griggs. I'm George Griggs's wife, you know, chief of staff under Al Gray, head of half the world, dirty tricks, special operations, wet ops. And he goes, no, I don't believe I know your husband. Exactly his words. Huh. And I'm taping it, by the way, because they took my tape. They started coming in and putting sticky stuff and, you know, just mind-jagging me.
Putting sticky stuff?
On the tapes. And, you know, they would go to a lot of trouble. They would take things that I said on one tape and put it on another. And they were having fun with me psychologically.
That's Kay Griggs there, and she was interviewed about 12, 13 years ago. She was the wife of the United States Marine Corps Colonel George Griggs. She's talking there, Martin, about mind jagging, coming into her house and playing with things, moving them around, this kind of thing, with this particular group at the top of the United States Marine Corps and Army Intelligence. And she also describes there this is a group that was carrying out wet ops. Now, that's a sort of parlance for assassinations.
Yes, well, I mean, are we surprised? I mean, these are allegations, obviously, that we just got her word for it, but let's face it, we know they get up to this stuff. They've been doing it for years. Is anybody surprised? And do we wonder why we're in such a mess?
So if you want to follow that up, it's Kay Griggs, K-A-Y-G-R-I-G-G-S, and it's about 3 hours altogether, that interview. Pretty mind-boggling stuff, talking about a cult, basically, in the US military. So that's all for this week. Coming up next, Sky News at 7 o'clock. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Shadow Treasury Minister, Labour MP for Bristol East, Kerry McCarthy, also to local peace campaigner Joanne Baker, and to Martin Summers. See you next week.
from the Sky News Centre at 7. Police helicopters are searching for a man who walked into a hairdresser's in Newport and opened fire. Three women are in hospital, but they're not in life-threatening conditions. Gwent police have recovered a gun from the salon. Superintendent Peter Keane says they believe the suspect escaped in a car.
The man that we're seeking in connection with this incident is believed to be in possession of a grey Mini Cooper car. Now, the last time that car was seen, it had a set of black furry dice in the windscreen. So we'd ask if anybody sees that car that they should contact us straight away.
An eight-hour gun battle at the British Council compound in the Afghan capital Kabul has left at least eight people dead. Two Brits managed to survive the Taliban attack, including a female teacher. A Scotland Yard detective has been questioned about allegations he leaked details of the phone hacking investigation.